Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Way of the Evolutionary Man. My name is Chris Kyle, and I'm on the board of the Academy for Evolutionaries, the organization producing this event. I'd like to extend a special welcome to those of you joining us for the first time. It's great to have you with us, and we look forward to getting to know as many of you as possible. I want to take a moment to introduce you to Academy for Evolutionaries founder, Craig Hamilton, who is the visionary behind this groundbreaking series. Those of you who don't know Craig, he is a pioneer in the emerging field of evolutionary spirituality. In his inspired writings, talks, and teachings, he calls us to awaken beyond the confines of the separate ego and dedicate our lives to the further evolution of consciousness itself. As the guiding force behind Integral Enlightenment, Craig offers spiritual guidance and teachings to a growing international community of thousands of students in 30 countries around the world. Through his online Academy for Evolutionaries, he teaches a series of experiential telecourses guiding participants through a process of spiritual awakening into an evolutionary relationship to life. Craig's work at Integral Enlightenment integrates decades of intensive spiritual practice with insights gleaned during his 8 years as senior editor of the award-winning What is Enlightenment magazine. For 13 years, he participated in the dynamic living laboratory of evolution known as Enlighten Next, under the direct guidance of its founder, Andrew Cohen, ultimately playing a key role in the leadership of this thriving international spiritual community. In his current work, he is helping to articulate an authentic evolutionary spirituality, an integral enlightenment, which illuminates the vital relationship between individual transformation and collective evolution. Craig is also a founding member of Ken Wilber's Integral Institute, a member of Deepak Chopra's Evolutionary Leaders Forum, and was a participant in the Synthesis Dialogues, a 35-person interdisciplinary think tank presided over by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. His celebrated conversations with other luminaries form the basis of the acclaimed webinar series, The Great Integral Awakening, Pioneering a New Spiritual Path, and Awakening the Impulse to Evolve, the Birth of Evolutionary Spirituality. He has also been a contributor to Shift Magazine and co-authored ION's 2008 Shift Report. Craig lives with his wife, Claire, in San Rafael, California. So welcome, Craig. I know I speak for all of us when I say how much I'm looking forward to tonight's event.
Thank you very much, Chris, and hello, everyone, and welcome. It's good to be with all of you again for the next installment of The Way of the Evolutionary Man. And I want to say thanks for all of your comments about the series so far. It's been a really rich set of dialogues, and I'm delighted to be continuing this evening with evolutionary evangelist and author Michael Dowd. For those of you who don't know Michael, he's the author of the best-selling book, Thank God for Evolution, How the Marriage of Science and Religion Will Transform Your Life and Our World. That book has been endorsed by 6 Nobel laureates and other science luminaries, including both noted skeptics and religious leaders across the spectrum, which tells you how much Michael can speak to everyone. He and his wife, Connie Barlow, who's an acclaimed science writer, have led a very interesting life for the last, well, probably their whole lives, but certainly for the last decade or so. They spent most of their time on the road, not living anywhere, but just having an itinerant ministry, roaming from town to town across the country, except that their ministry was preaching what they would call the good news of evolution and really helping to share their passion for evolutionary science and an evolutionary understanding of who we are and our place in the cosmos with as many people as they could. They've spoken to more than 1,500 groups across the country since 2002. And they're at home in both liberal and conservative settings, and they're uniquely gifted at building bridges between both the religious and non-religious, sharing the epic of evolution, our common creation story, in ways that uplift and expand our mind, heart, and soul. Michael's passion is showing how this deep time understanding of human nature in particular can inspire us and empower each of us to live our lives with greater integrity, joy, and zest for life. And the latest iteration of this work is a new online course that Michael and Connie have put together called Evolutionize Your Life, which we'll mention how you can learn about that at the end of the call tonight. Michael and I first met about 8 or 9 years ago when I was editor of What is Enlightenment magazine, and we came across their work and got turned on to them and invited them to actually visit us at our center in Massachusetts where I was living at the time, and they gave us a rousing presentation. And since then, we've had many opportunities to spend time together over the years exploring the mysteries of evolution. So, Michael, it's great to have you with us here for The Way of the Evolutionary Man.
Well, great. Thank you, Craig. It's a delight to be part of this series. I think it's an important one.
Thanks. Me too. So to frame it up a bit, as you know, what we're exploring here is what it means to be an evolutionary man. And what I'm meaning by an evolutionary man is this new kind of emergence that's happening today where a lot of us, not just men, but people are feeling called to participate in conscious evolution and the evolutionary process, waking up to the fact that we're part of an evolutionary process that actually needs us to contribute to it, participate in it, and recognizing that to do so requires us to also evolve ourselves, that we're part of this, we're perhaps the leading edge of this process, and that evolving the world means evolving our relationship to life, to ourselves, to our instincts, as I'm sure you're going to talk about, and really becoming more evolved human beings than we've been before. And you've been looking deep into the science of human behavior, and particularly the evolutionary science of what makes us tick. Why is it that we do what we do? And one of the areas we've been exploring in this series is just what exactly gender means in this postmodern world. Postmodernism has largely deconstructed gender for obviously a lot of good reasons, trying to help level the playing field between men and women. And it kind of ultimately came to the conclusion that gender is nothing but a cultural construct, that men and women are exactly the same if you take out cultural influences. But I know we're emerging on the other side of that purely deconstructive moment now and beginning to see that there really are some distinct differences between men and women that exist transculturally in a sense. And here, of course, we're interested in how we can understand those differences and perhaps use what we might call an evolved relationship to masculinity to improve our capacity to evolve the world. So I thought it would be great at the start if you could talk a bit about what we now know about what we might call the tendencies of the human male. How are men different from women?
Wow, great question, big question. With a question like that, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to approach it, but let me just try one way, and then we can maybe look at it from a different angle as well. One of the things that we know about, let me back up. One of the things that I'm so excited about is that we are in this incredible time in human history where we finally have global collective intelligence. I mean, we've gone through a series of transformations in terms of how we understand the nature of reality, and then how we understand what's important given our maps of reality. And, you know, reality has been experienced differently over the years. Reality in a tribal hunter-gatherer setting is not the same as reality in a chiefdom or a kingdom context, or reality in a city-state or early nation and so on. And we're now at the place where prior to global collective intelligence, we had competing maps of reality, competing maps of what's real and what's important. And we now have an understanding of our nature, our inner nature, and our outer nature that's gained through evidence, not through intuition or myth or stories or just, you know, people discerning what seems to make the most sense given their part of the world, but globally. And this question of what is masculinity, what is gender, what is the nature of humans, you know, what's universal to us, no matter whether you're Jewish or Christian or Muslim or Buddhist or atheist or, you know, whatever, there are certain things that are universal to human beings. What are things that tend to be universal to men or universal to women, or, you know, play out on a bell curve? And that's what we found, is that we really know evidentially that things do play out on a bell curve. You can't say all men are this way or all men are that way. But there are, as you said, profound things that we do now know about male brains and female brains that definitely, you know, most men have this kind of a brain. Most females have this kind of a brain. Most men have these hormonal patterns and so on. And I think one of the things that that does is it allows us to really celebrate both our uniqueness and our differences, but not from a place of arrogance or we are better than women or anything else. In fact, we have some serious limitations given the amount of testosterone and other things coursing through us. But in every culture, you're going to find a certain percentage of gender differentiation that doesn't fit the stereotypical norm. You find that among mammals. You find that among primates. You find, homosexual, bisexual, what could be called transgendered kinds of experience and tendencies throughout the animal kingdom as well. So it's an exciting time to be asking these questions in terms of what is our nature as men, what is our nature as humans, and then with that knowledge, how we can then co-create a healthy future together.
Yeah, fantastic. And clearly, a lot of this probably in some sense you could say validates sort of common sense, right? Probably a lot of it validates a lot of the stereotypes and what we kind of all knew anyway about men, but I think it would be really fresh to hear some of what we do know now at the cutting edge about the male brain, about male kind of neurochemicals that are influencing us and behavior.
Yeah, sure. Well, let me just jump into a few of the more compelling things. One of them is in the embryo, we all are born with basically female brains. But once testosterone starts being introduced, which happens very early in utero, it pretty radically changes the male brain. And then testosterone plays an enormous influence, as do other hormones. But let me just touch on testosterone for a minute, because, as Sam Keen has said, the function of testosterone in a human male is basically to produce the fight it or fuck it sort of response, which is one of bonding, intimacy, love, procreation, and the other is one of protection, defense, attack, gaining the, having the skill and the dexterity and the passion to, feed the tribe or whatever. And both of those are there, but one of the things that people aren't aware of, a lot of people I've found aren't, by not knowing the nature of our instincts, is that, for example, we now know that in all men and all women, this is a human universal, the higher the testosterone, the more people take risks and the more they think about sex. And you can take people that hardly ever think about sex and give them testosterone and they're going to be obsessed with sex. In fact, Connie and I stayed at the home of a dear friend and her husband in San Francisco Bay Area back 4 or 5 years ago, and she confided in us that a few years earlier her doctor had put her on hormonal therapy. She was on testosterone patches, and she told me, she said, after 2 days, she said, I couldn't stop thinking about sex. She said, is this what guys have to deal with? Well, it is, actually. It's exactly what guys have to deal with. And another interesting thing that's true, again, for all men. Now, this isn't true for all women, but it's true for all men, gay and straight, that when there's a significant rise in status, in fact, it doesn't even need to be a significant rise in status, when there's any rise in status, and it just is more pronounced, the more significant the status rise. Like if somebody gets elected into public office, or they become ordained, or become a megachurch pastor, or become the vice president of their corporation, or in any way where people are looking up to you and admiring you, you become a guru or spiritual teacher or whatever. Whenever people are looking up to you and admiring you, where they weren't looking up to you before, testosterone levels will sometimes skyrocket, sometimes a double, a triple, or quadruple. And so what that means is people are going to take greater risks, they're going to think more about sex, but they're usually going to be unconscious of it. In fact, this is a true story, and I can share this because I don't have to reveal who this person is. I've known somebody who's a sort of Western guru since the mid-1980s. We've been dear friends and did a whole bunch of NLP training together and all, and then since the late 80s, he's been teaching students and, is a sort of classically enlightened being, amazing human being. And we were just talking recently, a few months ago, and he shared that he found himself sort of obsessing about, 20-something women and started seeing a therapist as a result of it. And it wasn't until our conversation that he began realizing that, oh, okay, when I understand my instincts, I understand testosterone, it makes sense of what was seemingly problematic and that he was trying various spiritual or therapeutic approaches to deal with. And in fact, the piece about gratitude for his instincts, once he understood those instincts, made all the difference for him. The same is true for men of positions of power. I mean, I think it was Henry Kissinger who said, the greatest aphrodisiac is power.
Mm.
And he what he was getting at was that when there's a rise in power, when there's power, when somebody has that stature or that status, their testosterone levels are going to be absolutely astronomical compared to what they were before. And that's one of the reasons why we see so many political leaders, religious leaders, sports leaders, and others falling victim to sexual scandal. Because most of the time, the way they understand what's going on inside of them is through ancient maps of reality. They use language like sinful nature or shadow or ego or id, these sorts of labels that have been used to try to point to and are useful, but they try to point to sort of what's going on under the hood, but they're not based on an understanding of human instincts, and so they're not nearly as empowering and helpful in just a practical sense as understanding our instincts. So that's one of the things is testosterone. Mm.
And just to comment on that, because one thing that strikes me as really true about what you just said is that, you know, of course, probably everything we can learn scientifically about our instincts you could find in the vast treatises on human nature that have been written throughout the ages, right? You can find the correlates of that. But but with this new interpretive lens, there's, I think, a way that enables us to depersonalize this experience, which also, of course, was, I mean, if you look in some of the traditions, even the way they used to refer to some of these inner drives as demons also kind of depersonalized them, right? They were like this outside force that was attacking you. And so they did that, but of course there was a lot of mythological baggage that came with that, you know. But there's a way now when you kind of start to look at it this way, and I've heard you say this a lot, and it was in what you just shared, that there's a kind of, oh, okay, well, of course it makes sense that I would be attracted, in the case of the teacher you talked about, oh, that I'm attracted to these young women. It's in my genes, you know, it's in my body. And, oh, I don't have to, you know, the level of intervention changes because potentially you realize, oh, that's not a psychodynamic problem. That's not a unique psychopathology to me. That's something that's inherited that we all have. And now it's about my capacity to have some freedom in relation to that drive. You know, what choice do I make?
Exactly. And the paradox, the interesting thing is when women first learn, I mean, I speak about this all the time to all different kinds of religious and non-religious groups. And what has sometimes there is for women is when they hear this and they learn this, their immediate fear is, oh, great, now that men know this, it's going to sort of allow them to justify irresponsible or out-of-integrity behavior. And I have no doubt that that happens in some cases, but in my experience, both in terms of my personal experience of myself and in dozens and dozens of others that have talked to me about this, the exact opposite happens. It makes it so much easier to be in integrity when you're not judging yourself, condemning yourself, feeling guilty, or in denial. Like, I'm more spiritually involved. I don't deal with these kinds of things because I've overcome these things, or I've transcended, you know, my ego, or I've turned it over to Jesus, or, you know, whatever the different traditional approaches. But the one piece, I'd say the emotional piece, that is, at least in my experience, the difference that really made the difference. I mean, I had done so much personal growth and psychological transformation work and become trainers in a number of different disciplines, neurolinguistic programming and Ericksonian hypnotherapy and landmark education and just all kinds of stuff. But I never got the piece of gratitude. On the other side of course I'm this way. You know, of course we are this way. Can come this immense gratitude that if my ancestors didn't have the very same instincts that I sometimes can find challenging living in a modern or postmodern world, if they didn't have these instincts, I wouldn't be alive. And just meditating on it, they're just contemplating the fact that if my ancestors didn't have instincts for sugar, salts, and fats, for example, if my ancestors didn't have instincts to, you know, procreate when they could, and so on and so forth, I wouldn't be alive. And so to recognize that my very existence is only possible because my ancestors had those instincts allows me to feel grateful for what I used to judge or condemn or feel guilty about. And, you know, it's that old adage, what you resist persists. Well, in a very real sense, what you can honor transforms. In other words, what you can have an honorable stance towards, an honoring stance towards, that is respectful, appreciative. It starts with appreciation, and then it makes it, you know, easy to tame your instincts. It's not so much that we have mastery over our instincts, but when we respect them, when we honor them, when we can have gratitude for them, their power can serve us rather than sabotage us. And that's the key piece that has made it almost effortless. It's not entirely effortless, but it's far more in that direction than anything I had ever experienced before, and it was coming to gratitude. The depersonalization piece can be helpful. I don't think it's necessarily that's the difference, but I think gratitude and appreciation, that sense of honoring, it is the difference that makes a difference. And it's the kind of honoring, it's the kind of gratitude that can really only come from knowledge. You know, it's like, have you ever been to a presentation or maybe a funeral where somebody's doing the funeral service, but they didn't know the person who died, so they can't really speak from experience mm-hmm. about the person. Mm-hmm. So they try to sound intimate, but it just leaves you sort of flat. Or if somebody's introducing somebody else as a public speaker, but they've never read their book, they don't really know that much about them. It's like it rings sort of hollow. There's a sense of authentic respect and honor. You can honor a speaker. You can honor someone who's dead if you really knew that person. And in the same way, when you really know your instincts, when you understand what's been going on for millions of years, why our instincts are the way they are, that they really make sense from an evolutionary perspective, and why it is that for millions of years that we've been programmed to be this way, to think this way, to feel this way, then that honorable stance, that gratitude stance, can allow us to have a very different relationship toward the same things that last week caused us to stumble or last week caused us to feel guilty. This week we can be empowered and inspired by those very same instincts.
Yeah, well, that's a powerful reframe for sure. And to just turn this back again to this question about men, so you spoke a lot about testosterone making such a huge difference in the male and how that can shift and change in response to life events. What else defines men? You know, in what other way? What are a few other ways in which we're distinct in our tendencies?
Well, a few come immediately to my mind. One of them is the tendency towards aggression, the tendency to, defend, protect, to fight, to be intense, to go from 0 to 60 fast. The tendency to not pay attention as much to our feelings, and also even to physical wounds. You know, Connie and I have this sort of standing joke that, sometimes she'll look at me and she'll say, how did you get scraped or how did you bump yourself or whatever? And I'll look at it and I'll say, well, I don't know, just being a guy. I mean, I wasn't even aware of how I cut myself or how I scraped myself or I bumped myself or whatever. And emotional pain, things that happen emotionally, I tend to forget much more quickly than any woman I've ever been in a relationship with. And again, that again plays out on a bell curve. It's not that all men are that way. But these make really good sense when you look at what have men been doing, not just men, human men, but what do male primates do? What do male, our closest genetic cousins, for 7 million years, we've been, 98%+ of our genes are identical to the bonobos, the pygmy chimpanzees, and the regular chimpanzees. So when you look at what the chimps, the bonobos, and the humans have in common, and then beyond that, what the great apes in general have in common, what have the male part of our primate hominid heritage been dealing with for the last 5-7 million years and longer? And you start realizing that, if we've lived under these conditions, given these factors, and in order to survive and thrive, we needed to be this way, well, it's not a surprise that those things have been profoundly and deeply ingrained, such as arrogance, such as aggression, such as sexual the desire to procreate whenever we get the opportunity sort of thing. As well as sort of how we deal with our own feelings and how we deal with intimacy. And so the exciting thing is that where we're at now is, again, when we have gratitude, when we have appreciation that comes through knowledge, we then have more choice. We can then, it's not a matter of overcoming these instincts, it's a matter of recognizing them, honoring them, and then allowing those very same instincts to serve us. And part of it is because, let me use a personal example. I have very high testosterone. It caused me to be in problems in the past. It has been challenging in different aspects of my life, especially my late teens and early 20s, but not just then, since I was married as well. And by understanding my nature now, when I see, when aggression comes up, or and I get intense, or I get whatever, I can much more quickly have a witness stance. I can notice myself doing it much more rapidly, sometimes in the moment, but often very quickly right afterwards. It makes it really easy to apologize. I have no, there's just no hesitation in being able to say to somebody, hey, wait a second, the way I just said that, I really apologize. That was shitty, or that was just, you know, whatever. Because I there's no tendency to denial, because I have a full embodied embrace of my nature. It just makes so much sense. So there's no part of me that thinks I should have evolved beyond that, or I'm evil or bad or sinful, or I shouldn't be that way, or it's weak to be that way, or any of that. So now when I see a very attractive woman, it's like I immediately think, well, of course I think she should be carrying my baby. But I don't act on it. It's easy to be in integrity, and Connie jokes with me about it. Sometimes, actually, she'll see a woman before I will, and she'll say, I know, she deserves to be carrying your baby, and we'll both chuckle. And it's a way, although, to be honest, in the last 2 years, now that I'm 52, we've more often said, I know, she deserves to be carrying Shane's baby. Shane's my 27-year-old son. Yeah, but again, it allows us to be light. We're more everybody that I've known, and that Connie and I have known together, and it's hundreds of people that have embraced their instincts, that have come to really cherish their own nature. They have more compassion for themselves than they've ever had before. More compassion for others, more understanding of others. So we tend to be more forgiving, we tend to be more accepting, but not accepting in sort of the sense of letting people run us over. It's just like, oh, we can talk straight to each other about our instincts, because it's not like we're treading on, you know, thin ice, or walking on eggshells, or feeling guilty or ashamed. It's just this peace, this happiness that comes from knowing our nature and then saying, okay, if this is what's real, now what's possible? How can we be with each other, whether it's around aggression, or whether it's around our, you know, sometimes self-centeredness, or whether it's around our arrogance or sexuality, or our cravings for, you know, foods that have sugar, salts, and fats, and on and on and on.
Yeah, no, this is just a lot of directions to go here. You, when you start to look at our male behavior through this particular lens, I'm just thinking about all this in the context of our spiritual aspirations as men to really evolve and become more conscious, and also our aspirations to play a bigger game in the world too, because I think one part of this evolutionary impulse is I really want to be up to something. I want to actually make something happen. And you know, when you spoke about some of the things you did, well, obviously anybody who starts to play a bigger game in life, make things happen, okay, your testosterone's going to rise. You're going to have to pay more attention to that, or you could get tripped up in certain ways. What are some of the – I mean, I think also about, like, there's a tendency among men – you brought up arrogance, and there's also this kind of certainty, which is, in some sense that is the nature of arrogance, right? I already know better than any of you. But, if we're going to forge into the future together and be available to discover what's new, we have to be willing to let go of what we already know and again, that's kind of pushing against our primate heritage, I suppose you could say.
But it could be, yeah, it is, but I'm really glad you raised this question, Craig, because I think it's a vital one. If we ask ourselves, what keeps men from playing full out? What keeps men from really making the difference that is possible for them to make? Well, it's not an infinite number of things. It's usually around the same kinds of things that human beings find disempowering. It's just in their sort of uniquely male form. One of them is guilt. There are few things that disempower us more than guilt. And guilt is a natural, healthy, normal emotion. It basically means you've been out of integrity somewhere. You've violated someone's trust. You've broken an agreement. You've done something that's harmed somebody else without ever acknowledging that that's happened. You know, there's sort of a handful of things that produce guilt, and that's a good emotion. It makes good evolutionary sense. But if we deny it, if we pretend it's not there or simply ignore it as a signal, then we don't do what it takes to relieve ourselves of that guilt, which is usually being in communication with somebody and owning that you hurt somebody or owning that you broke an agreement or owning that you, you know, betrayed somebody or whatever it is. And so one of the things that I've found that this understanding of our nature, this you know, understanding of our instincts does, this knowledge-based understanding, is it allows us to let go of judging ourselves so that we can much more easily clean up the wake that we've left. And then we can literally come to the place where we have no guilt because all the guilt has motivated us to have communication with individuals so we can act, we get to the place of having no guilt. And when that's the case, it is profound, the energy that's released when we have no guilt and when we have no resentments. But we don't just get there alone. It takes being in communication with others usually. And the other thing about playing big is that it's so vital to, I think, interpret our lives mythically. I mean, we have four main instincts that we understand brain-wise. We have physical instincts, that is instincts for things like safety, sustenance, and sex, which are grounded in our reptilian part of the brain, the most ancient part of our brain. We have relational instincts, social instincts, related to feelings, emotions, bonding, kinship. In other words, we have instincts for status, we have instincts for play, we have instincts for bonding. And that's in the more recent part of the brain, the paleo-mammalian part of the brain. Then we have interpretive instincts, that is, our instincts for meaning-making, for interpretation. That's the neocortex part of the brain. And we also, interestingly enough, that it's very freeing when you really get it. At first, it's usually disturbing, which is we have instincts for self-deception. That is, for really good evolutionary reasons, we are actually instinctually programmed to deceive ourselves. In fact, if people just put cognitive biases in Google, you go to the Wikipedia page for cognitive biases, and you'll see all of them categorized, and you can actually link to the different ways that we're actually programmed to deceive ourselves. That's why it's so important to have a group of men. That's why men's groups are so important, is because integrity is not a solo sport. It's a team sport. We need each other. So understanding that we have instincts for self-deception, and in the same way that you wouldn't expect a wolf or a bear or an elephant to go counter to their instincts very easily, well, we don't go counter to our instincts very easily. So understanding that, when you can come to the place of having no secrets, you know, having no resentments, having no guilt, not because you've cleaned yourself of guilt, but you've actually communicated to the people that have made you feel guilty because you've been out of integrity or whatever, you can play a big game. The energy that's there, I mean, I've known guys that have gone from needing 9 hours sleep a day to 6 hours sleep a day almost overnight by having certain communications with people in their life because, you know, they stole this from that person when they were a teenager, or they fucked around on this person but they never cleaned it up, or, you know, whatever it is that we've done, because all of us, literally 100% of us, have stuff in our past that we feel guilty about, that we feel ashamed about, that we wish were different. And when we communicate, and it doesn't even have to be that often, if you could take one person a month and just communicate to one person a month that you've in some way had a less than a perfect, you know, impact on in the past, and you communicate to them, and the communication doesn't have to be major. It can be something like, hey, I just want you to know that I had a negative impact on you, and I know that, and I never acknowledged that before, and I just want you to know that I know what a shit I was, and I'm really sorry. If I could go back and do it again, I'd do it differently. Boom! The energy that you get, the energy they get, it's just miraculous communication. So that's the kind of thing that's possible in terms of men playing a big game, because then they can interpret, again, it's that interpretive instinct, they can interpret their life mythically. Like, what does God, what does the universe, what does reality want to do with and through them? And huge energy is released when we're no longer carrying around resentments, when we're no longer carrying around guilt, we're no longer carrying around secrets.
Yeah, Michael, it's all really fascinating and opens up, I'm sure, a lot of questions for folks. I know I have a bunch more, and we'll get to them in just a sec. We're going to take a short break to hear a word about the organization producing this event, and we'll be right back. I'm Craig Hamilton. I'm speaking with Michael Dowd. As you're probably aware, The Way of the Evolutionary Man is being brought to you by the Academy for Evolutionaries. And I wanted to just take a moment and tell you a little bit about our work. Our mission, if you will, if you boil it down, is to really empower those of us who are feeling called to make a great contribution to the world, but to do it from an awakened place, from an enlightened place. Our work is rooted in the recognition that in order for the world to change, human beings need to evolve ourselves, and that those of us who are on the leading edge of consciousness and culture right now need to be the ones to lead the way by doing the deep work of evolutionary spiritual transformation in ourselves so that we can carry that into the world. We've recognized that evolution doesn't just need more fans and cheerleaders on the sidelines. It needs awake, conscious, wise participants who've evolved themselves to the point that they're capable of serving and guiding this process of human emergence that we're all a part of. We've created a 9-week online telecourse called Integral Enlightenment, Awakening to an Evolutionary Relationship to Life, in which we've brought together everything we've learned in over 15 years of evolutionary leadership to create an unprecedented opportunity for you to take a leap in your evolution. To learn more about this unique training opportunity that starts this month, visit academyforevolutionaries.com. That's academyforevolutionaries.com. You're listening to The Way of the Evolutionary Man. I'm Craig Hamilton. I'm here with Michael Dowd, author of Thank God for Evolution. And Michael, you were just speaking about, in a sense, how we can begin to liberate our energies and free up a lot of energy that's been going into avoidance and denial of guilt and other things, issues, things we've done wrong in the past that we haven't cleaned up. And the trajectory that was, I think, starting to take us on was how we can start to free that up to be able to make a greater contribution in the world, to be able to really live the life of significance that we feel. Because I think we all have a calling of sorts that's often unrealized, and we're looking here at how do we get mobilized on that path. And one thing I think would be really intriguing in light of this conversation about instincts that you've been sharing with us is, so, you know, the way we often think about those kind of instincts is as something that, you know, as you've often pointed out, they're mismatched with our time. Our instincts evolved a long time ago when life was really different than it is today. And now they don't really match the world we're in. And so in a sense, we're trying to become more conscious of them so we can make better choices, you know, almost often better choices in spite of our instincts, you know, that it would guide us to make not such healthy choices. But another piece I know you speak about, and I'd love to bring to this inquiry, is how can we use our instincts to our advantage, if you will, or our tendencies, or even perhaps, as you said, our the fact that men have a lot of testosterone, and that leads us in certain directions. Well, how can that testosterone be mobilized toward the fulfillment of our own lives, but also toward our greater contribution to the world?
Yeah, great question. Well, the first thing to acknowledge is that it can, and it can very, very powerfully. And the key to that, I think, is integrity, being in right relationship to reality. That's what I mean when I use the word integrity. Especially, I've come to start using the term big integrity, because sometimes people think of integrity as just being nice or being honest. And, you know, it includes being honest, of course, but it's larger than that. I'm meaning it in terms of what does it mean for me to be in right relationship to all the different faces of reality in my life? What does it mean to be in right relationship with my spouse, with my children, with my ex-wife, with her partner, with my mother, you know, all the different people in my life, my coworkers or whoever? And then what does it mean to be in right relationship with my bioregion, with my watershed, with my city or village or wherever I happen to live, with my country, with my world? And so it's one of the most fruitful questions to ask is, what does it mean in this relationship to be in right relationship to reality? And it's going to be a little bit different. I mean, my first relationship to Allison, my first marriage for 13 years with Allison, we shared, you know, we had 3 kids together, and the last half of our marriage, we had an open, committed relationship, meaning that we were occasionally intimate with others, but we were completely honest and transparent about it with each other, and nobody was being lied to. And, you know, it was partly as a result of, I've known since 1988 that up until the agricultural revolution, that is up until about 10 or 12,000 years ago, we were not monogamous by nature, and you know, and so knowing that about my nature, it was like, okay, how can I be in integrity? Well, so being in a non-monogamous, responsibly non-monogamous relationship with Allison was part of what it meant to be in integrity. Well, that's not true for Connie. Connie requires and needs a monogamous relationship with me, and at the first year or two of our relationship, it was challenging because I didn't see myself as naturally monogamous, so it was a challenge. But once I gained this understanding of my instincts, the very same energies that used to cause me challenge actually served me. So now it's easy to be in a monogamous, loving, committed relationship. I'm not romantically intimate with anybody else. I'm not sexually intimate with anybody else. But I still have those same thoughts sometimes or inner feelings, but now I chuckle at them and I allow those same energies to serve me. And it's the same with a whole, it's not just sexually, it's about all the different things, because yes, our instincts are so mismatched. I mean, every other animal, without exception, there's no other animal whose instincts cause them problems. Their instincts serve them. Their instincts are what lead to their survival and reproduction. But for the last 10 or 12,000 years, we've become increasingly mismatched with our instincts because our world keeps changing so dramatically, which is counter to what our instincts evolved for millions of years to have us do and think and feel, so that we now, every year, it literally becomes more and more challenging, especially when the media and the advertising industry can so easily manipulate us by appealing to things that we're instinctually programmed to pay attention to. And we're usually unconscious that we're instinctually programmed to pay attention to these things. And so we're manipulated around food and our attention and status and you know, TV and advertising and everything else. And so coming back to your question, once we appreciate our instincts, we can then develop an evolutionary witness, a witness that doesn't come from just sitting on a cushion and meditating. It comes from an understanding of our brain, an understanding of what's really going on under the hood. And then we can be light and have compassion towards ourselves. And then those very same instincts for aggression, for sexuality, for passion, for making a difference, for defending the tribe, when we extend our sense of self to have our sense of self include the entire body of life, then that same energy of protecting and defending and doing something great in my lifetime becomes one that can profoundly serve my community. And it really does align. It's like my own self-interest, my small self-interest, and my large self-interest, my planetary self-interest becomes aligned, or my universal, or as Ken Wilber talks about, our cosmic self-interest becomes aligned, so that I'm simultaneously serving the self-interest of the planet or the larger body of life, and my own small self-interest is served at the same time. There's not a conflict between the two. And that's what I think being in integrity, being in big integrity, being in right relationship to reality, that's what gets unlocked or unleashed when we come into right relationship to reality. And we need each other to do that, which is why I so love, I mean, one of your guests in the series is Bill Kauth, and Bill is one of the main people in the men's movement. And I can't recommend, for anybody listening to this, I just want to say, I highly recommend the New Warrior Training, the Mankind Project, because it's one of the most powerful tools for men to get authentic with themselves and each other and then have a support community to empower them to fulfill their life purpose, their mission.
What seems really helpful about what you've been sharing is that, you know, in some sense, I think a lot of men today are trying to find our way into a new embrace of what we could call the masculine or our masculinity, because, you know, postmodernism did a lot of work to kind of say, well, the masculine is bad. I'm oversimplifying, but there's a way in which, you know, we've all heard a lot of rhetoric about how the patriarchy is what's created all the problems on the planet. It all started with the patriarchy, and that in a sense all men are in the patriarchy still, and we're trying to free ourselves from it. And so then many of us have swung to try to become more feminized, more feminine, hoping to balance out that sort of evil masculine to a certain degree. And, you know, some people might not relate to what I'm saying, but I think at least many of us, or most of us, have been somewhat under the sway of that, or had to grapple with that, or at least when we were in college, we had to deal with it quite a bit. So it's just, you know, it's interesting to begin to look at, to separate these things out and to really begin to see, well, what might it look like? Because I for one don't think that the sort of end game is to for men and women to become exactly the same. Like as the evolved man is just sort of perfect balance between the feminine and the masculine. The evolved woman's the perfect balance. It's like even when you're super evolved and super conscious and even pretty enlightened, you still show up in some ways that are gendered. And so let's, you know, get beyond any ambivalence about that. And then what happens when we're no longer ambivalent about being maybe masculine and let them kind of let that rip, but now in the context of a higher calling, as you were saying.
Right. Yeah, exactly, Craig. I mean, one of the things that, just speaking very personally, one of the things that coming to embrace my nature, like to really with gratitude, again, I keep coming back to Thomas Berry's term of honorable. One of my favorite quotes from Thomas Berry, one of my great mentors who died a couple of years ago at the age of 94, he's one of the main mentors of almost all of us in this sacred evolutionary movement. He said, "The world within and around is an honorable world. To refuse this deepest instinct of our being, to deny honor where honor's due, is to place ourselves on a head-on collision course with the ultimate forces of the universe." And what he was getting at there is that when we have an honorable stance, and a sense of gratitude and respect that comes from knowledge, it allows us, for example, I'm a very masculine person. I've got a lot of testosterone. I move through the world in a very masculine way. But there is a softness, there's a kindness, there's a gentleness, there's a generosity that has emerged only since I've come to embrace in the last 7 or 8 years this understanding of my nature. So now, because I don't have anything to prove anymore, and I'm not ashamed of my nature anymore. And so, for example, Connie and I have this little goofy thing that we do now, we've done for the last 5 years, that's become the centerpiece of our marriage, that it is the reason that we stay at a scale of 10, on a scale of 0 to 10, 10 meaning it just can't get any better, we're like at a 9.9 or a 10 virtually all the time. Because we've got this little goofy thing that we call the pathetic path to empowered relations. Now, it's not in my book or anything else, but I will eventually write something about it.
Okay, true confessions coming out here.
Yeah, exactly. And what it is it's like because I'm a big man, almost 6'1", and I've got a big man way of being in the world sometimes, I get to do this little goofy, pathetic thing with Connie all the time, and we've been doing it for 5 years, and it never gets old. For example, in any given relationship, all the communication and the behavior isn't 100% loving and generous. I mean, that's just what it is to be human. Well, sometimes that stuff, sort of builds up over the course of a day or a week or whatever, and just kind of, we nip those suckers in the butt every day. If Connie says something to me that's not 100% loving and generous, I'll sometimes tuck my shoulders over, and I'll just sort of droop over, and I'll just sort of tiptoe out of the room with this little pitter-pat, this pathetic little walking, and I'll say something like, "You're yelling at me again." Now, that's something I'd never do before, but what it does is it taps into an instinctual pattern that when somebody is a victim, and you're not really pissed at them, if you're not really upset with them, you naturally, instinctually, like instantaneously have compassion. And so she has to come and find me, especially because she knows I'm going to go hide in a closet or I'm going to go down where she has to find me and I'm just going to whimper. And she can hear me. And so she comes and gets me. And we do this a dozen times a day. And she'll sometimes say, somebody's yelling at somebody. And we do this little pathetic thing. But as a man, I get to just be goofy. But what it does is it has us laughing and touching and kissing a dozen times a day. And we've been doing it for 5 years. It never gets old. Now, I don't do it in public very often because people wouldn't understand. In fact, we shared this with a dear friend, and I explained this to her, and she said, "You don't share this with others, do you?" And
too late now, Michael. The word's out. We're going to put video cameras in your house. In fact, get this on YouTube.
But it's so fun. It is just so fun. And actually, somebody did it to me in a public presentation. I mentioned this publicly about a year ago, and somebody asked a question, and I responded sort of fast, and she just stopped, and she gave this droopy eye, and she said, "You're yelling at me," and the whole place busted out laughing. It was the funniest thing that happened that evening, because, again, it taps into our instincts for compassion. And what my point, even sharing this, is that it allows me as a man to be fully masculine, but But I'm now able to be in touch with my more yin side, my more what sometimes gets called feminine side, not because I'm willing it or trying to be. It's just that I don't have anything to prove. I know I'm a man. I know I'm a strong man. I know I'm sometimes arrogant. I'm sometimes aggressive. I'm sometimes, you know, in charge. And, you know, Connie will say, well, I know you can protect me from saber-toothed tigers. And I'll say, yes. And then I'll say, thankfully, they're in short supply. You know, I don't have to prove that one. But it allows all of us, I think, who really embrace our instincts to recognize that, yes, and if we can be an evolutionary man, and part of it is we can grow and support each other in growing in integrity. We don't have anything to prove, and we can then sort of step into that place that you and I have talked about before, where our great joy and the world's great needs intersect. And those places where our joy and the world's needs intersect is our calling. It's our mission. It's where we can make a unique contribution to the world. And I don't think there's anything more exciting than doing that work with other men, and doing so from a place of really saying that, yes, I am committed to growing in integrity. It doesn't mean being perfect overnight. It may take months or in some cases years to clean up our past or to come into deep integrity. But when we simply make one step, you know, a month in that direction, it releases so much energy. And it also allows us to be authentic and vulnerable with each other, so which is a bonding thing. And our women in our life are going to appreciate it. Our brothers are going to appreciate it. And it's just where we can, I think, really help our species to evolve, because we are evolving ourselves by being in right relationship with our own reality, our own nature.
This is all really fascinating stuff. There's something that's coming up I'm wanting to just get into a little bit more here. I just want to tease out a distinction and see where you kind of sit on this. And it has to do with, because you've been speaking a lot about embracing, honoring the instincts as kind of a core path, and I think you've really elucidated why that's been so powerful in your own life and in the lives of others. And what I want to kind of understand is, so, you know, there are many people today in the kind of personal growth type arena talking about this. It's a big move of, you know, in a lot of the shadow work, et cetera, is, you know, embracing our darker sides. They don't necessarily use the scientific language or lens that you're bringing, but it's this, you know, we need to embrace all of our humanness. We need to, you know, acknowledge all of our weaknesses, all of our foibles, all of our failings, and all of our what we might call negative tendencies, which we've been speaking about here as well. And I just know, you know, I'm a spiritual teacher. I work with a lot of students. And in my own work, I find it's a kind of a fine line. Like, there's the right way to do that, and then there's another way to do that, where you really end up letting yourself off the hook for your freedom of choice that you always actually had in the face of your instincts and tendencies and predilections. And let me just put a little finer point on it. So for instance, you know, like I can speak for myself, being able to see what I'm made of and what has made me tick has been tremendously important on the path. Like, one of the most critical pieces to be, and in my case, it wasn't so much through a scientific lens, but it was just, yeah, through this larger kind of, I guess, instinctual evolutionary psychology lens of realizing, okay, why we are the way we are, how this whole human animal works, beginning to recognize, okay, I'm just a mammal. Sometimes I'm just a lizard. You know, I've just got all these parts to me and all that's there. But on top of all that, oh, but wait, I'm also always a human, meaning I'm also always somebody who has the freedom to choose which impulses I respond to. And so when I do harm, yes, that was my perhaps an instinctual response that I chose to follow and that did some harm because I got, you know, inappropriately aggressive or angry or in whatever other way, you know, hurt somebody. But hey, I did really choose that. And for me, I would say in looking at it, to me, what seems to make people really transform to a different level or a different order of humanity is it's around that choice issue and starting to have actually a healthy, evolved conscience in relation to the choices that we make and continue to make in response to all this instinctual and other forms of conditioned behavior. So I just wanted to see where you land on that, because that's kind of that feels like a pivotal piece.
Yeah, it really is, and it may be a piece where you and I see the world differently. I don't know. We'd have to explore that. But the issue of choice is a really crucial one. It's a really important one. But there are many, many aspects of our instincts that we have no choice. And the example one of the examples I think that clearly illustrate that is around what's called supernormal stimuli. Deirdre Barrett wrote a book in 2010 called Supernormal Stimuli. They've done, for example, studies among many, many different animals. Here's the one that's really easy to understand, is that if you replace an egg for many, many species of birds with an egg that's just a brighter color of whatever its eggs are, or it's slightly larger or has more pronounced features like polka dots or whatever, it doesn't have choice. It will always sit on the fake egg. It is choiceless in that. It'll never learn. And its children will never learn. It's programmed to do that by millions of years of evolution. And in the same way, we are programmed to, you know, all kinds of things that we really don't have choice. We can think that we do, but it's kind of like the elephant and the rider analogy is the one that two New York Times best-selling books have used, that the elephant is the deeper parts of the brain, the reptilian brain and the paleomammalian brain. It's our emotional brain. It's our deep instincts for sexuality, for safety, for sustenance, for sociality, and so on. And then our interpretive instincts and our co-creative instincts, which are the more recently a part of all parts of the brain, that's where choice comes in. That's the rider on top of the elephant. But when you think about a rider and the elephant and the relationship between the two, as both these New York Times best-selling books, Jonathan Haidt's book, The Happiness Hypothesis, and then a book that still I think is number 9 or 10 on the New York Times bestseller list even now, called Switch, How to Change Things When Change is Hard by Chip and Dan Heath, both of them speak about this rider and the elephant. And the rider thinks it's in control. The rider has convinced itself that it has choice. But the rider is only in fact in control if the elephant doesn't have strong desires of its own.
Well, let's take this to the human example, because we don't have a lot of time, and I just wanted to drill in on it. So you've spoken here about obviously something that's been a big issue for a lot of evolutionary men. It's been a big issue for a lot of male spiritual teachers, you know, sexual promiscuity in the face of a vow to be monogamous. And clearly, I don't have a choice as to whether I'm going to feel lust in any moment. It's just going to arise at certain times, and at other times it might arise very intensely. But I certainly have a choice whether I choose to sleep with this person.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
And
that's what I'm talking about. We can't choose how we feel, but we can choose how we act.
Right.
And that's the piece.
Exactly. I'm right with you. I mean, I think that that's the key piece, is that it makes it really easy, or relatively really, really easy, to choose the integrous path, to choose something that's in integrity, that's impeccable, when we don't think of those impulses as either our sinful nature or, you know, something that we have to, you know, if we have a dishonoring relationship to those inner drives, we're less likely to choose in a positive way. If we have an honorable relationship, it becomes much, much easier to actually make those choices to be an impeccable integrity. And it's not even an issue. It's not a struggle anymore.
Sure. Okay, well, we just have a couple minutes, and I want to give you kind of a little open mic here, just really to all the evolutionary men who are listening right now, if you just had a minute or so to say something that, what would be of immense value for every evolutionary man to know who's really aspiring to evolve himself and evolve the world?
Three things come to mind. Thanks for the question. One is, as I already mentioned, I highly recommend the New Warrior Training, the Mankind Project, both for the experience of the weekend, but also the community of men. I also suggest really having at least one or two or three other men that you can just really be authentic, completely transparent with. And then the other is that Connie and I have just created a course called Evolutionize Your Life. And it's really sort of a, human thriving, the science of human thriving 101. It's basically how to really have an honorable relationship to your instincts so that whatever your spiritual path, whatever your therapeutic path, whatever else you're doing in your life to have a great life and thriving relationships, it will be supercharged because you'll have an understanding of your instincts that's based on knowledge and honor, an honorable stance, and that just makes it much, much easier to be in integrity. So those would be the things that I would most recommend. And you can learn about the Evolution of Your Life. Just go, I think it's evolutionizeyourlife.com.
Yeah, evolutionizeyourlife.com. And I know there you actually have a free audio seminar you've put together that you and Connie, where you really take people through this perspective in a deeper way. So I really invite everybody to check that out.
Yeah, and the course itself, I think, is evolutionizeyourlifecourse.com.
I got it. Okay, great. Well, Michael, thanks again. It's always a pleasure to talk, and I know this was really illuminating for me, so probably for everyone else.
Well, Craig, thank you. And once again, this is about the third time in the last few years where you have played a significant evolutionary role. And I think that having these series of conversations with this amazing caliber of men is going to make a real difference. It'll ripple out for years to come. So thank you.
Thank you, Michael. If you're interested in diving deeper into the conversation, be sure and join our Facebook group where you can participate in discussion forums on any of the topics discussed today. Just go to facebook.com and search for The Way of the Evolutionary Man or click on the Facebook link in the email we sent you today. If you want to learn more about my work, visit integralenlightenment.com or academyforevolutionaries.com. And if you have any friends you think might be interested in the series, please forward them one of our emails so they can join us. If someone sent you this audio or you found it in some far-flung corner of the Internet and you'd like to listen to the other dialogues in this series, visit thewayoftheevolutionaryman.com. Now we're going to shift gears and get started on our new virtual Evolutionary Cafe. Every day following the teleseminars, you have an opportunity to come together with a small group of fellow evolutionary men in a facilitated conference call to explore the topics that we discussed on the call. We have a technology maestro conference, which allows us to break you up into small groups, very much like a workshop, and then we'll offer questions and some guided group inquiry. And you can find full instructions on how to do that in the email that we sent you earlier. So see you there. Thanks again, everyone.